Graham Hancock has become recognized as an unconventional thinker who raises legitimate questions about humanity's history and prehistory, offering an increasingly popular challenge to some of those entrenched views of Orthodox scholars. He graduated from Durham University with first-class honors in sociology. He then went on to pursue a career in quality journalism, writing for many of Britain's leading newspapers. He's a great researcher. I call him legendary Graham Hancock on Coast to Coast AM. Graham, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you, although I have to confess to quite a bad cold.
Oh.
I had a bit of a sore throat, which is going to affect my voice in this discussion, but apart from that, I'm feeling good.
You're on for 3 hours. If you get to a point where you think it's too much strain, you let me know, okay?
No, I think we'll be fine.
Great. I got to tell you, I've been inundated over the past several months with people who have requested that you come on the program, and
Great.
You were in the mix anyways, but you've got a great fan base here in the United States and Canada, Graham.
Yeah, I really appreciate my U.S. and Canada readers. I really appreciate them sticking with me and their sense of curiosity and their desire to know about the unknown and their feeling for mystery.
Let me ask you something also, Graham. You've got an upcoming conference called CPAC. Where is that going to be?
Well, that's going to take place in Sedona in Arizona, and that's been organized by Walter Cruttendon, who's been on your show.
Sure.
It's taking place on the 12th of November. And that's looking at the mysterious issue of precession and the world ages, how the time that human society passes through seems to be cyclical in nature, and how we rise and fall, reaching a high level of civilization and then falling back into a dark age and rising up again. And Walter has put forward an astonishing new theory on this in his book Lost Star of Myth and Time, and this theory suggests, in short, that our sun is revolving around another star, and thus our planet is being carried on a gigantic journey through space, and it passes through certain regions of space where the electromagnetism is different. This affects the consciousness of the human race, and accordingly leads to these rises and falls in human society. It's a theory which really explains many of the mysteries that I went into in my book Fingerprints of the Gods, and I believe that Walter Cruttendon is onto something really special with this theory, and that's why I'm attending this conference to support him, give a talk at the conference, and I hope any listeners who might be able to come along would do so. Details of the conference are on my website, which is www.grahamhancock.com, and there's a list of, on a page called Supernatural, there's a list of my lectures, and one of those is at this conference where the details are.
Great. Well, I hope a lot of your fan base goes out there, Graham, because they really enjoy the work, the investigating that you've done. Supernatural, I mean, an incredible work, not available yet in the United States, will be very shortly. I think you can get it out of Canada, can't you, right
well,
now?
Well, here's the thing. It'll be published in U.S. bookshops next year.
Okay.
Right now, we're working out the final negotiations with U.S. publishers. The Canadian edition is published, in fact, today, and the Canadian edition is available on Amazon.com as well. So people will, if they do want to buy the book, will be able to buy it immediately through Amazon.com. Just search Graham Hancock Supernatural, and it pops up on Amazon.com. So that'll be posted within the U.S. and should be a normal price. And again, details of this are on the Supernatural page of my GrahamHancock.com website.
I mean, this really is a remarkable piece of work. Now, all your work is good, but you seem to constantly step above each time you come out with something, and Supernatural, Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind, is another one of those. How did, and we're going to get a lot into this tonight, but how did you start investigating these mysteries?
Okay. Well, It's a long story in a way. As my readers will know, I have spent more than the last 10 years intensively examining the possibility of a lost civilization. Was there a great civilization, perhaps around 12,000 years ago, that was wiped out in the cataclysms that marked the end of the last ice age, but that left us some legacy of knowledge? And I've explored this idea in a series of books. The best-known book was Fingerprints of the Gods back in 1995, but with Heaven's Mirror and Message of the Sphinx, I have taken this exploration further still. And I reached a point around 2003, latterly with Underworld, my last book on this subject, I reached the point where I felt that I had really said everything that I had to say on the subject of the lost civilization. I don't want to become one of those writers who ends up repeating himself simply because there's interest in a particular subject
right.
that he has covered. I don't want to just go on re-exploring the same area. I felt that it was time for me to move on
mm-hmm.
and to investigate something fresh and new and take my approach, the same approach that I took in Fingerprints of the Gods, into an entirely new investigation. And for many years, what has interested me enormously is the question of human origins. What on earth are we? What are we human beings? Why are we here on this planet? Is there a reason at all that we're here on this planet? What are we doing? Do we have some kind of special destiny? Why, although we are genetically astonishingly close to the apes, to chimpanzees and gorillas, just 1.2% difference in the DNA, why is our behavior so completely and utterly different from the behavior of the apes? Why do we have religion and spirituality and symbolism? I wanted to explore all of this. And I decided quite a while ago that I would do a book about this and devote 3 or 4 years of my life to investigating it. As I started to investigate the subject, I quite quickly found where I really needed to focus, because the story of the human career, if you follow the anthropologists and the scientists, is a 6 million year story, starting from the last common ancestor with the chimpanzee. But frankly, for 99% of that 6 million years, it's an incredibly boring story. Nothing happens. Slow anatomical evolution until our ancestors begin to look like us. But the behavior is just unbelievably dull. They work with the same kind of stone tools for literally millions of years. They never innovate. They have no creativity. Even when they start to look exactly like us, even when the human brain size is identical to ours, which is about 200,000 years ago, this boring, uncreative, dull-witted, lacking in innovation, this kind of dull behavior just continues. And it continues all the way down to really the very recent past, just 40,000 years ago. And then suddenly, it's as though a light has been turned on in the human brain all around the world. And really, it all seems to happen at once. And we see the most extraordinary evidence that a new kind of creature is on the planet. That creature looks just the same as he'd looked for the last 140,000 years since we became anatomically modern 200,000 years ago. He looks the same, but his behavior is totally different. And we see the great cave art of Europe introduced around 35,000 years ago. Fantastic works of art. Picasso, when he went into Lascaux Cave, came out and said, "We have invented nothing." Those ancient artists were far ahead of the artists of today. And we see this rock art appearing all over the world, not only in Europe, but in Southern Africa, in Australia, in Asia, anywhere you care to look, in North America too. This extraordinary art appears, and at the same time, our ancestors become innovative and creative. We see dramatic changes in their hunting strategies. They become much more efficient. They become really sharp. And they believe in life after death. We know that because they bury grave goods with the dead. Clearly, they believe that the soul continues on a journey after this life, something that they never thought of before.
But only with this new brain, only with this new type of person did they start doing that, right?
That's right. It's like a new type of person has appeared, and yet the person looks identical to the person that had already been on the planet for tens of thousands of years. So something changed, something happened to our consciousness. Something altered the way we look at reality and altered the way that we behave. And that change changed everything. It set us on the road to modern mankind. It was the single most crucial evolutionary step in the entire story of the human career. And it happened less than 40,000 years ago. So that's where I decided quite quickly that I needed to focus this investigation on. I needed to understand why that radical change took place and how it could possibly be explained. And that set the scene for the investigation that I explore in Supernatural.
Graham, do you think that change was biological in that there perhaps was already a ticking clock within that person, that human being, and then all of a sudden, you know, the alarm went off and so this new person came out?
Well, I think that it's clear that the human brain had already evolved to its modern capacity, size, and structure by 200,000 years ago. There were no further physical changes in the brain. What happened that, for, as I say, that was 200,000 years ago. Another 160,000 years had to pass, and that's an awfully long time. Another 160,000 years had to pass before that already established brain started behaving in the way that we expect human beings to behave. So some dramatic incident affected human consciousness, some dramatic incident or experience which rapidly spread all around the world. And I think I know what that incident or experience was, and I go into this in great depth in the book.
Well, you know, you had said earlier, what on earth are we? And another question could very well be, what not on earth are we?
Well, yes, this is a point, and perhaps we'll come to it later in the interview,
yeah.
Because in this dramatic explosion of consciousness, we must seek for explanations. We must try to understand why it happened, and it is one of the explanations for why it happened was provided by the Nobel Prize winner Francis Crick, following on from his work on DNA. Astonishingly, although Francis Crick was the ultimate mainstream scientist, indeed he defines what the mainstream is, Francis Crick did not believe that our DNA had evolved on this planet. But I'll just plant that thought with you at the moment.
Sure.
And perhaps we'll come back to it later on.
Were you influenced beyond Francis Crick of other people? I mean, the Jacques Vallée, the other researchers of our time, did anybody have an effect on you?
Yes. Jacques Vallée's work was very important, and the reason that Jacques Vallée's work was so important was because Jacques Vallée noticed the astonishing similarities between modern accounts of abductions by aliens and much more ancient medieval, particularly medieval European accounts of fairies and elves and abductions by beings of that sort. Now, I came to this because, as part of my research, I had to work with shamans all over the world. And shamans often take hallucinogenic drugs, plant hallucinogens, to enter altered states of consciousness, where they then encounter beings that they believe are spirits. And these beings give them teachings about how to heal the sick in their society very often. And often the information is absolutely hard and solid, useful information. Which leads to the shamans mixing up combinations of plants that really do contain powerful medicinal effects. Now, what I found was that these spirits that shamans encounter, and we'll perhaps come on to the fact that I myself have encountered them in altered states of consciousness, that these spirits very closely resemble the beings that modern humans call aliens. The whole idea of an alien abduction, of a person being drawn up, perhaps on a beam of light into the sky, or climbing up a thread of light into the sky and entering a spaceship, and they're small beings with triangular heart-shaped faces and dark eyes, do strange experiments on them and stick needles into them and put implants into their skin. Astonishingly, exactly the same experiences are had by shamans in the Amazon, shamans in the deserts of South Africa, shamans in Australia. But they don't call them aliens. They call them spirits. So what's happening is that the human race, we human beings, are having extraordinary experiences that we interpret through the framework of our own culture. But the experiences are all the same all over the world. It's just what we call them is different. In medieval Europe, as Jacques Vallée realized, we call them fairies and elves.
Right.
In the shamanic cultures, we call them spirits. And in North America and Britain today, people who've had the experience of being abducted on what they think are UFOs call them aliens. But maybe the answer is not any one of those things. The first thing we have to realize is that there's a unique, common, shared human experience. And I believe it was that experience, 35,000 or 40,000 years ago, that switched on that light in the head of the human race. I think it was contact with these supernatural beings, with the experiences that one can only have in altered states of consciousness, that led to the dramatic change in human behavior. And that's why the subtitle of my book, the title is Supernatural, but the subtitle is Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind.
And it seems, Graham, that these ancient teachers, and I'm talking thousands of years ago into the area of Jesus and that time period and onward, all seem to have, as is exactly what you just said, similarities of events that have occurred through this altered state of mind.
See, this is the astonishing thing. We human beings have difficulty enough. If you get 10 people together in a room and ask them to witness an event, you're going to get 10, you know, slightly different descriptions of what happened.
If you're lucky. Yeah.
We have great difficulty on agreeing on things that actually take place in the so-called real world right in front of our eyes. And the mystery is that human beings from all the different cultures on this planet, wherever they come from, whatever their personal background, and even far back in the past from the reports that have come down to us, once they enter an altered state of consciousness, we could call it a shamanic state of consciousness, and it isn't only hallucinogenic drugs like ayahuasca in the Amazon that can achieve this effect. There are other physical techniques such as rhythmic dancing all night long that achieve this effect. What the mystery is that then the experiences had in altered states of consciousness are defined by most scientists as illusions, as fantasies, as non-real. But the mystery is that humans everywhere, all over the world, all see the same thing and agree on what they've seen and even meet the same beings who have the same messages for them. Now, for me, this is a gigantic mystery of the human condition, and this is where I focused my investigation in Supernatural.
And I assume you have to try to battle within yourself, Graham, to decide if it's a physical thing of the brain or if it's something else.
Well, the conclusion that I've come to, and again we'll come to it later, is that even if it is a physical thing of the brain, then we have to explain why this extraordinary library of images and interactive experiences is programmed into all our brains. Why would evolution do that? And why would it make those experiences only available to us in altered states of consciousness? When we're in those altered states, we're absolutely useless in the physical world. A Stone Age man in an altered state of consciousness, seeing visions, could have been eaten up by a saber-toothed tiger any minute, and he wouldn't have been able to do anything about it. So why did evolution select for we humans to have these extraordinary images and experiences programmed into all our brains and passed down from generation to generation? That is almost as big a mystery, if not a bigger mystery, than the possibility that spirit worlds are in fact real and can be accessed by all of us in altered states of consciousness. We have to explain these shared, universal, non-real experiences.
And
whatever explanation we come to, the answer is completely and utterly astonishing.
And why did it wait so long?
Well, I think that there's an element of chance in this. There are many plants that grow around our planet, which shamans know a great deal about, which, when ingested, produce the altered state of consciousness in which these visions become available. I think that there are certain human beings, and I think the figure is around 2%, statistical work has been done on this, who can fall into an altered state of consciousness spontaneously. But my suggestion is those people had as little impact on their society 60, 70,000 years ago as UFO abductees have on our society today, that those individuals were probably marginalized and not listened to.
True.
But that at a certain moment, our ancestors stumbled across these shamanic plants. Perhaps they first ate them thinking that they were food. Then the plants unleashed these astonishing experiences. And remember, plants have evolved alongside us. The plants unleashed these astonishing experiences and resulted in a kind of critical mass of consciousness change taking place in human society, and that this happened around 40,000 years ago. And very quickly, those cultures that had not encountered such plants learned about them and totally changed the way they behaved.
Stay with us, Graham. We'll be back in a moment. Fascinating. The work is called Supernatural: Meetings with the Ancient Teachers of Mankind. I'm George Norrie, along with Graham Hancock. We'll be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie, Graham Hancock with us live in London. Graham, if people who have felt that they've been abducted by aliens are not under the special brew of ayahuasca or magic mushrooms or getting this kind of shamanic music or rhythm, as some of the shamans are and others, how then do they experience this same kind of phenomenon?
Because they're very special people is the simple answer to that question. The evidence shows, and the evidence that I've gathered in my book, it demonstrates this clearly, that around 2% of every human population, and in the case of the United States, that would mean several million people, around 2% of every human population has the ability to fall into the right altered state of consciousness, the right trance state. state spontaneously. Their brain chemistry is so organized that they can reach that state without taking any substance and without using any of the shamanic techniques such as music and rhythmic dancing. And I believe that the answer to this mystery is that the UFO abductees belong to that 2% of the human population who are able to spontaneously enter an altered state of consciousness and access these experiences, which I believe to be real experiences that affect our consciousness, to access these experiences which would normally not be accessible to them. There are a variety of different ways of falling into altered states. One that I haven't mentioned is electromagnetic fields. It's been well established that intense electromagnetic fields directed at the human brain can induce exactly the same kind of shamanic altered state of consciousness and again give access to these experiences. And sometimes when you have large numbers of people in one place seeing the same extraordinary and inexplicable beings and events, it may be because they've all been subjected to the same electromagnetic field, and this can often be released in areas of high seismic activity during earthquakes, for example. So it's as though in our evolution on this planet, we've found every possible way to enter these altered states. Clearly, these altered states are very, very, very important to us. And in my view, the experience that UFO abductees have and continue to report is an experience of enormous importance, which is fundamental to us in understanding the human condition. And it is a tragedy that our society, the Western society today, both in America and in Britain, has become so materialistic, so tied down to material reality, to things that can be weighed and measured and counted, that we take everything so literally that our scientists are unwilling to consider the possibility that what these millions of UFO abductees are reporting may in fact be real in some way that those scientists do not understand. Because the experience affects our consciousness, primarily our consciousness, it is often very difficult to find real-world evidence for it, and that allows scientists to dismiss and ridicule these experiences. I believe they're making a terrible mistake, and I've devoted a large chunk of my new book to explaining why.
Graham, does this, though, negate the fact that so many millions of people have witnessed strange craft, strange types of beings all around this planet?
It doesn't negate the fact. That is precisely what is witnessed. The way that those visions are interpreted will vary from culture to culture. If you're dealing with a tribe in the Amazon rainforest, they may see it as a flying canoe in the sky. But nevertheless, they're seeing a strange object in the sky where it shouldn't be, with beings inside it that one does not normally meet in everyday life. So the interpretation may vary from culture to culture, but I believe the experience to be real but elusive in this world. This is an experience primarily to do with our consciousness. It's as though a door can be opened, a secret doorway can be opened inside our minds, which allows our consciousness to flow through into another level of reality. Quantum physicists call those other levels parallel dimensions.
Exactly.
And to encounter the beings that live in those parallel dimensions and that seem to have a great interest in us. Now, UFO abductees, because they are spontaneously able to fall into this state, and because they've grown up, when they have grown up in Western cultures and been bombarded by the rational materialistic ethic of Western cultures, are often very confused and terrified by what happens to them in these states, and they don't understand it. Whereas shamans in the Amazon or in South Africa or in Australia have become the masters of these experiences, are able to put themselves into the correct state of consciousness very rapidly and understand exactly as what is going on with them. And the shamanic view, I believe, is the view that we need to listen to in the West today, which says that whether we like it or not, we are involved with these supernatural realms. We can stick our heads in the sand, we can pretend that they aren't there, but they are there, and they affect us, and they affect everything we do. And if we had any common sense, we would force ourselves to learn about these realms, and to learn about these experiences, and to understand what is going on there, and to master these issues in exactly the way that shamans do. In fact, it may be that shamanic cultures around the world have a powerful lesson to teach to the West, to show us that our arrogance and our confidence in our own philosophical position, the belief in nothing is what I would describe the philosophical position of the West, a refusal to believe in anything. Shamans can teach us that that is wrong, that it's a mistake, and that it may even be holding us back in our evolution. And the shamans in our culture are the UFO abductees. They are the spontaneous trancers who can access these experiences. And what do? We ridicule and revile them. We don't realize that they're a precious asset for us.
And we don't even question them in a very methodical way. I mean, a few people do. The Bud Hopkins, the late John Max did that.
Wonderful work of John Mack. Thank goodness for John Mack and Bud Hopkins and all the others. David Jacobs, for example, working in this field.
John Carpenter used to do this.
John Carpenter, fantastic work, who've been willing to set aside scientific prejudice and just talk to the human beings who've had these experiences and to record their experiences and to begin to understand what's going on. And it's from the work of men like David Jacobs and John Mack, Bud Hopkins and others, that we come to understand that this experience is a universal experience. It's a worldwide experience. People all over the world have it, and our science has utterly failed to explain it. Instead of explaining it, it ridicules it and laughs at it. What a mistake.
Perfect time, Graham, for us to chat about your type of experience in the Amazon.
Yes.
And why you even did this.
Well, you see, my background is as a journalist. I used to be, as you mentioned in the intro to the show, I used to be a reporter. I worked for major newspapers. I was the East Africa correspondent of The Economist.
Mm-hmm.
And my position as a professional and as a journalist has always been that if I'm going to write about something, I must, as far as possible, experience it myself. Why should I waste my reader's time with pure speculation? I have to put myself into the situation I'm describing. I have to experience what I'm describing. And what I'm describing in this book is the experiences that people have in altered states of consciousness and how these experiences have dramatically and radically affected the course of human evolution and human history. And as I've mentioned, shamans down the ages have developed many different techniques for entering altered states of consciousness. First off, you could be one of the 2% who can enter altered states spontaneously. Unfortunately, I'm not one of those 2%. I do not enter altered states spontaneously. I could have entered the correct altered state by doing rhythmic dancing for 24 hours until my nose starts to bleed. But that's not for me either.
No.
I'm not good at rhythmic dancing. I could starve myself for 40 days. I could plunge hooks through my skin like they do in the Sundance of the Lakota Indians in the United States. All of these things, all of these techniques produce the state of consciousness that gives us access to other realms. But the most widespread technique throughout the world that shamans use is the cultivation of certain very special plants. And these plants contain what our scientists call hallucinogenic substances. And again, our scientists tend to dismiss their importance. And these plants put us into the correct altered state. So I decided that what I needed to do to have the experiences that I was going to be writing about was, first of all, to go to the Amazon, rainforest. And I went there and I spent 5 weeks there with different shamans throughout the Amazon drinking a substance called ayahuasca. Now, in the United States, and let's state this very clearly at the outset, ayahuasca is an illegal drug. Ayahuasca is a Schedule I drug. You drink that drug in the United States, you get caught, you're going to go to prison and have
away.
A very bad experience because our society is engaged in a war on consciousness. Our society does not believe that people have the right to explore their own consciousness. Although I can't understand why, because if our consciousness, if we do not have sovereignty over our own consciousness, then we have sovereignty over nothing, and we might as well forget the great issue of living in a democracy. We are not free if we're not free to choose what to do with our consciousness.
And should this beverage be taken under the guise of a shaman?
Yes, I believe absolutely that the ayahuasca beverage must be drunk under the guidance of a shaman, and that's why I went to the Amazon to drink it. These are very powerful substances. The experiences that one has on them can be extremely disturbing, and it's very important to be in the company of an individual or individuals who've been there before and who know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And this this substance is an astonishing mixture of two different plants. There are 80,000 different species of plants and trees in the Amazon. Out of those, the tribal peoples of the Amazon discovered that two particular plants, when mixed together, produce these astonishing effects. And scientists who've looked into this cannot understand how they managed to realize the effects of combining these two plants. One of them is a vine, which is in fact the ayahuasca vine, and the word ayahuasca means the vine of souls.
Interesting.
And the other is a leaf from a bush called Cicotria viridis. They call it chacruna in the Amazon. If you consume that leaf on its own, it will have no effect whatsoever. It contains a powerful hallucinogen called DMT, but an enzyme in the stomach destroys DMT on contact. The mystery is that the other ingredient, the ayahuasca vine, switches off that enzyme in the stomach and allows the DMT to be ingested orally and then produces these astonishing effects. And I drank ayahuasca 11 times in the Amazon, and it transported me into an absolutely convincing, seamlessly convincing, alternative reality filled with intelligent beings, many of them very like the aliens that UFO abductees describe, who I had never believed in before. I believe in them now because I experienced them directly under the influence of ayahuasca.
Do they communicate with you, Graham?
Yes, they communicate, and the communication is telepathic. It is wordless. You sense that it's rather like, I'll tell you what it's like. It's like going for the first time to a country you've never been to before, where they speak a different language mm-hmm. from you. And you meet a person in that country, and that person has something very important to tell you, and you need to hear what that person's got to say. But you don't know the rules of communication yet. You're a stranger in a strange land. And that's what I felt like with my first ayahuasca visions. I had to learn a whole new code of communication and contact in these altered states of consciousness. And I would say towards the 11th time that I drank ayahuasca, I was beginning to get to the point where clear information was coming through. And I could understand exactly why shamans say that this plant is a teacher, that it contains lessons for us. It passes valuable and vital information to us, not only about the healing properties of plants, but also about our own personalities and what we need to do to better and improve ourselves as human beings. All of this is part of the ayahuasca experience as well. And although we in our culture despise and revile drugs, I need to emphasize that not all drugs are the same. And in fact, ayahuasca has been used very successfully in getting people who are addicted to hard drugs, to dangerous, dreadful drugs like heroin and cocaine. It's been very successful in getting people off their addiction without withdrawal symptoms. And the reason for that is that it takes them on an inward journey where they confront their own problems and difficulties and understand why they've become addicted and resolve never to be addicted again. And amazingly, huge numbers of people have had the hook of these hard drugs taken out of them forever by the hallucinogen ayahuasca.
Yeah, I believe David Icke has also ingested ayahuasca.
I don't know David Icke personally, but I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I think he has.
I think that this is a very important experience, and what I would emphasize again is that the place to have this experience, if possible, is in the Amazon. I would not urge anybody to get hold of the ingredients of ayahuasca and mix it up in their own room. They may have a very frightening and disturbing experience. They may get the dose completely wrong. It would be wrong to do that. The place to drink this substance is amongst the shamans of the Amazon. And fortunately, shamans from the Amazon are now increasingly visiting the West and offering ceremonies involving ayahuasca because they feel that they have a mission to the West. They feel that the spiritual sickness of the West is destroying the world, that we need to reconnect with spirit realms. We need to shake up our consciousness and understand what we're doing to the planet, what we're doing to the Amazon rainforest. And so the shamans of that area feel that they have something vital to teach us, and I think they're right.
This ingesting of the brew, does it perhaps go beyond what's in the consciousness and maybe open up a portal to those other dimensions that are out there?
So I believe that's exactly what it does. You know, the scientists are presently investing billions of dollars in the largest scientific instrument on the planet, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland. And the purpose for that is to use this world's science to explore parallel universes. Quantum physicists are already convinced parallel universes exist, but they don't know how to get into them. Maybe the answer has been much simpler all along than multi-billion dollar gigantic machines. Maybe the answer has been known by shamans for at least the last 35,000 years. Maybe it's to do with this fantastic instrument inside our own brains that we only use a tiny proportion of today. Maybe it's a matter of retuning the receiver wavelength of the brain to allow us to pick up other realities that are definitely real, but that are not normally accessible to us in a normal, alert, problem-solving state of consciousness of the kind that our society presently values.
Graham, when people remote view, are they doing something like this?
They are indeed doing something like this. Remote viewing, I believe, involves first a journey into the alternate world, the parallel world, the other world. And in that other world, all things become known, all things become visible. One anthropologist who worked in the Amazon drinking ayahuasca with shamans, rather as I did, during one ayahuasca session was approached by the shaman, and the shaman said to him, "I have something really sad to tell you. Your grandmother has died." His grandmother was in New York City. 4 days later, he got the message that on exactly that night, his grandmother had died. The shaman had made an out-of-body journey, and that journey had taken him to New York, and he had seen the death of this woman. So that is remote viewing. Happening under the influence of an experienced ayahuasca practitioner and attested to and reported by an accredited anthropologist.
You know, it's interesting. Our CIA for years conducted clandestine mind work, trying to do remote viewing, trying to do a number of things. When they very simply could have used this kind of technique, they might have gotten it right away.
Absolutely. That's what's so important about this kind of technique, is that it is repeatable and to a certain extent controllable. And in fact, experiments can be done with these substances in scientific labs, although the environment is not very nice. Nevertheless, the possibility is there. And we'll get on later on to discussing the extraordinary work of Dr. Rick Strassman at the University of New Mexico, who received the first federally funded approval to conduct experiments with dimethyltryptamine and human volunteers for 20 years. For 20 years, all scientific work with hallucinogens had been banned. And in the early 1990s, Rick Strassman got permission to go ahead and run DMT tests with human volunteers. And the results that he got, the astonishing results that he got from exploring altered states of consciousness in a systematic way, really do shake up our view of reality. And they certainly shook up his view of reality.
We'll be back. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk a little bit more about, of course, Francis Crick and some of his thoughts. As you mentioned, I'm very fascinated to find out why he believes that something from outside somewhere had an effect on this planet. We'll be back. Graham Hancock, our guest right here on Coast to Coast. Graham, tell us about the work of Dr. Rick Strassman. You were mentioning him a little bit. And when did he do this kind of work?
Absolutely. Just before I do that, can I just give another heads up to your listeners about the visit I'm making to the U.S. during November?
Absolutely.
I'm going to be giving two public lectures. One of them we mentioned earlier is at Sedona on 12th of November for the CPAC conference. I'll be talking there. And the other one is in New York City on the 17th of November. I'll be lecturing on my new book, Supernatural, and showing slides to support the lecture at the Chapel of the Sacred Mirrors in New York City on the 17th of November. And again, details of all of this are on my website, www.grahamhancock.com, on the Supernatural page. Anybody who's interested in attending either of those lectures will find full details there. And just the last heads up that I'd like to mention, my new book, Supernatural, is not yet published in the U.S., but it will be next year in the bookshops and is available right now immediately from Amazon.com and Amazon.ca in Canada. Just search Graham Hancock Supernatural.
Aren't websites fantastic?
I think websites are wonderful. I think they've brought the world together. I get people sending me messages from China and Fiji and, you know, the United States and Germany and all over the world. I feel it's made me part of a huge community, and I really love it. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful thing.
Two individuals I want to talk about this hour, of course, is the work of Rick Strassman, and also we'll talk about Francis Crick again as well. But tell me about Dr. Strassman.
Okay, well, Dr. Rick Strassman is a fascinating man, a brilliant scientist, and he's a psychiatrist at the University of New Mexico. And back in 2001, Rick published a very important book called DMT, The Spirit Molecule. And that extremely important book outlines the results of his fascinating research. This was the first research using hallucinogens and human volunteers that had been authorized by the federal government of the United States for more than 20 years. And Rick started this research in the 1990s and finished it in the late 1990s, using hundreds of volunteers and administering to them the powerful short-acting hallucinogen DMT, which is also the principal ingredient of the ayahuasca brew in the Amazon. Now, in the Amazon, because it's mixed with another plant, the effects last much longer. They last 2 to 3 hours, whereas DMT given in pure form, as Rick Strassman did at the University of New Mexico with his volunteers, produces an extremely powerful out-of-body journey into another realm that lasts only about 20 minutes, and then full normal consciousness returns. Now, Rick's project was, first of all, to discover whether there was any therapeutic value to DMT. But, of course, in our society, we define the notion of therapeutic value very narrowly. As Rick started to administer this substance to his volunteers, he began to notice, as he compiled their reports over a period of years, that all of them, even though they didn't actually know each other very often and had no shared or common background, that all of them seemed to be reporting meeting the same beings in their altered state of consciousness.
Isn't that something? The same ones.
The same ones with in the same extraordinary settings, and that these beings seem to want to communicate with them and communicate information to them. But even more intriguing, 80% of the volunteers reported experiences that were absolutely identical to the experiences that are reported by UFO abductees, by people who believe they've been abducted by aliens on board UFOs. And yet we know that the bodies of those volunteers were not abducted onto a UFO, because they were lying right there on a hospital bed under Rick Strassman's watchful eye in the University of New Mexico. But their consciousness, as they reported it, seemed to take on a body of its own, and that consciousness body then traveled into the other realm and met these extraordinary beings. And many of the same things that the beings are reported to do to alien abductees, such as putting implants into their bodies, doing strange experiments on them, interfering with their reproductive system, manipulating their DNA. These experiences were all reported by Rick Strassman's volunteers. Now, skeptics might say, ah, well, the obvious answer to this is that those volunteers had been reading the tabloid press, and they simply regurgitated from their imagination the imagery that's already out there in the culture. But Rick Strassman has a complete answer to that. And that is that other experiments using DMT were done in the early 1950s with human volunteers in Europe. At that time, although there had been some UFO sightings, nobody in the world was reporting abductions by aliens. And yet, those human volunteers who were given DMT back in the 1950s did report exactly the same experiences that we now record as alien abductions. Small beings with triangular heart-shaped faces and large dark eyes abducting them up to some strange space in the sky and conducting painful experiments on them. So what becomes clear from Rick Strassman's work is that the reason this imagery is in our culture in the first place is because it has been derived from altered states of consciousness. Now, here's the intriguing thing that Rick has established. The pineal gland in the human brain produces DMT. the powerful hallucinogen. We actually make it in our own body.
And I think as you get older, that production slows down.
Yes, it can slow down. It's particularly active in younger people. But what Rick suggested, to cut a long story short, is that that 2% of the population who spontaneously fall into trance and have the alien abduction experience may do so because their brains have overproduced DMT and changed their consciousness, retuned the receiver wavelengths of their brain, and allowed them access to the other realm. It's very important to emphasize that Rick Strassman is not a reductionist. He doesn't reduce this to just brain chemistry. He believes that what is happening is that, or what may be happening, is that we need to understand the brain as a receiver, rather like a television receiver. Mm-hmm. And for most of us, that television receiver is tuned into channel normal all the time. And actually, we do need to be tuned into channel normal, at least most of the time, in order to function in the daily world. Otherwise, we would become dysfunctional. And one can see why evolution has set the receiver wavelength of our brain on the particular channel appropriate to life on this planet. But that what happens when we take a substance like DMT, or when our own brains overproduce it, or when we use other shamanic techniques to enter altered states of consciousness, is that the receiver wavelength of the brain is altered, and we pick up, well, Rick calls it channel DMT, where real beings, utterly real reality that is not accessible to us in ordinary states of consciousness, suddenly does become accessible to us. So he was suggesting that these experiences are absolutely real, but that our very materialistic science cannot get to grips with it because it is only accessible in certain states of consciousness. And those states of consciousness may be mediated by DMT, and that it cannot be an accident that our evolution has given us this potential. Evolution gives us nothing unless it's useful. And it therefore suggests that these altered states of consciousness are incredibly useful to the human species. And indeed, to come back to the theme of my book, I do argue that the extraordinary before and after event that took place in human prehistory around 40,000 years ago, when a light was suddenly switched on in our heads all around the world, precisely had to do with our discovery of altered states of consciousness, which gave us access to these other realms and to the vital information that is available to us in those realms.
Did Strassman change gears when you said that he initially started to test for therapeutic use of DMT? Did he ultimately change his entire study to undertake happened to the mind?
Yes, in a sense, that was forced upon him by the reports of the volunteers themselves. Within the rather narrow framework that the West defines therapeutic value, he could find no therapeutic value for DMT. But what he did find was that it seemed to open a doorway inside our minds that lead us through into another dimension, and that these experiences are extraordinary and mysterious and desperately need to be researched. But precisely because he couldn't pin down in the narrow Western frame a specific therapeutic value from those experiences, he was in fact unable to continue with his research. And he wrapped up his research towards the end of the 1990s, and then published the results in his book DMT, the Spirit Molecule. And those results caused Rick Strassman to change his own view of reality. He is now absolutely convinced, as I am, that reality is much more complicated than we imagine, and that the very small part of reality that we normally relate to, like an iceberg, the tip of the iceberg is above the surface, but 9/10 of it is below the surface. 9/10 of reality may be below the surface of our normal everyday consciousness, but it may be vitally important for us to find ways to access that other 9/10 of reality below the surface, and that's what altered states of consciousness appears to allow us to do.
Graham, can we assume that through this altered state, where all these people witnessed the same thing, that these beings that they found in either other dimensions via this portal, that they indeed do look like the Greys then that so many people have talked about, that they do physically have the long arms, the big heads, and they have the big black eyes?
That does seem to be the case. Let me tell you something astonishing. There are even paintings of those beings in the painted caves of Europe going back 35,000 years.
Oh, my.
Human beings have been encountering these other beings for at least 35,000 years, and we have a definite record of their presence in the painted caves of Upper Paleolithic Europe, and I report this in detail in my book Supernatural. It's documentary evidence for encounters with precisely the same sort of beings as our modern alien abductees report. And in fact, if you go and talk to shamans in tribal societies today, you will find that they are also reporting the same kinds of contacts with the same kind of beings. And this is a great mystery, and it really is almost perverse to deny that there is something real behind it when we find that it's an experience that not only affects us today, but that affected our ancestors 35,000 years ago, and that at that time was clearly and undeniably connected to a radical change in human behavior that made us the species we are today, that actually made us human.
If these alien abductees are traveling in their conscious mind, so their physical bodies, of course, remain, as we were talking about. Why, then, do we hear so many reports of these experiments that are being conducted on what they think might be their physical body?
And indeed, they sometimes find physical implants in their physical bodies.
True.
Yes.
True. Now, but if
I think
if,
the answer to that is that I want to call it the spirit world. I honestly don't believe that we are dealing with nuts and bolts aliens who come here in flying saucers from a distant part of this universe. I think we're dealing with transdimensional beings who approach us from different dimensions that evolution has given us the opportunity to relate to in altered states of consciousness.
Even though we may be years behind where they are.
Even though we may be millions of years behind where they are, even though we may have nothing to teach them and they may have everything to teach us, that these experiences are available to us in altered states of consciousness. So the mysterious thing is that those beings from other realms or other dimensions, if that is what we're dealing with, and I believe that that's one very good answer to this mystery, they seem to have a particular project with us. It's almost as though they want to gain for themselves the physicality that we have. And this is why so many alien abductees report reproductive work being done on by the alien beings. And again, astonishingly, shamans in the Amazon and in South Africa and in Australia report exactly the same thing being done to them by spirits. In fact, they often report that they have a wife or a husband in the spirit world, and they've produced children in the spirit world, and that these children have this rather strange appearance with large heads and long limbs and exactly like we describe our aliens. And so it seems that there may be some kind of breakthrough from the other dimensions into our dimension, and that this breakthrough may be purposive, it may be intended, and we desperately need to know what's going on with it.
This is just fascinating work that you and Strassman and other people have done in this arena. If this is happening, and these beings are trying to do whatever they're doing, is it possible that there's something evil behind it?
Yes, it is possible that there's something evil behind it.
Oh, my.
The spirit world is not all goodness. I do believe that there are forces of darkness and forces of evil at work in the universe, as well as forces of good. And that those, just as we may encounter manifestations of those forces in this physical world, we can also encounter it in the other world. And that's why it's very important to be armed and prepared and alert before undertaking consciousness journeys of this sort. And this is precisely why shamans in places like the Amazon really do have something to teach us, because they are not the passive victims of these experiences. They have these experiences at will, at their own will, at their own choice, and they access those experiences primarily by drinking the brew that we've discussed earlier, ayahuasca. And then they send their consciousness into the spirit world, and instead of being the victims of the spirits, they become the masters of the spirits, and they work with the spirits, and they find those that are good, and they work with them against those that are bad. And part of the shaman's mission is to reduce the evil forces that fall on this planet from the supernatural realms.
Do you believe some of this could also be attributed to what people think might be angels?
Yes. I think that every supernatural experience that humans have ever reported, whether it be angels, whether it be demons, whether it be fairies, whether it be elves, whether it be ghosts, remember that the shamans constantly meet the spirits of deceased ancestors, that all of these experiences are accessible and only accessible in altered states of consciousness. And this is precisely why these experiences are so elusive in this physical world. Because we see the experiences through our own cultural filter, we may define them in different ways. For some people, they may say the being is an angel. For another person, he may say the being is a spirit. Another person may say the being is an alien. But at the end of the day, there's a being there who does not conform to the rules of our everyday reality. And beings that don't conform to the rules of our everyday reality are best described as supernatural beings.
I got to tell you, Graham, the work, is much needed. It is unfortunate that mainstream science really doesn't touch it too much.
Mainstream science, apart from great scientists like Dr. Rick Strassman, has turned its back on this area of inquiry. Without any good reason, without any serious work being done on the matter, our society has created a gigantic prejudice against altered states of consciousness. You know, we're very happy for people to blitz themselves into oblivion with alcohol every night. We're very happy for people to close down their mental processes by watching endless hours of the most awful television. But if a free and independent adult chooses to experiment with his own consciousness, to explore his own consciousness through sacred plants that grow naturally alongside us on this planet. If an individual does that, then he can be sent to prison in our society. We so value the alert, problem-solving state of consciousness needed to deal with the everyday world that we have simply neglected, cut off, ignored, dismissed the other 90% of our consciousness, and it was that 90% of our consciousness, I believe, that made us human.
We'll be back with Graham Hancock in a moment. We're going to continue this incredible story, this journey. By the way, Dr. Strassman was a guest on our program back about a year ago when he talked a little bit about this. Truly a remarkable man. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Graham Hancock, our guest. Graham, let's talk a bit, if we can, about Francis Crick. And sparked my interest when you talked about the ability to see the dead. So we'll get into that as well. Now Crick wins the Nobel Prize for his work of structure of DNA. Some have said that he himself might have been in a altered state.
Yes, this information astonishingly came out just 8 days after Crick's death. He had suppressed it during his life, and he threatened to sue any newspaper that published it, but he admitted that the information was true. In the early 1950s, when Francis Crick discovered the double helix structure of DNA, he regularly consumed LSD. LSD at that time was completely legal, and Crick felt that it enhanced his mental and creative powers. He took low doses of LSD virtually every week, and he admitted that it was under the influence of LSD in a visionary state that he first saw the double helix form. And it is that vision that enabled him to crack the code of DNA, and it's on the basis of that vision that he won the Nobel Prize. And he, in fact, is one amongst many scientists who have received vital information of a scientific nature in altered states of consciousness. So that's the first remarkable thing about Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, the ultimate mainstream scientist, that Crick saw the structure of DNA, the double helix structure, under the influence of LSD. But there's more. Our scientists today are absolutely, most of them, are absolutely against the idea of any kind of intelligent design in the universe. They dismiss it utterly, right, as a new ploy of creationism. They laugh at it. They ridicule it. They just despise the idea. And yet the greatest scientist, one of the greatest scientists of the 20th century, Francis Crick himself, did not believe that the DNA molecule had evolved on this planet. And believe me, as a scientist, Francis Crick was far beyond those scientists who now dismiss intelligent design.
Let's mention that one more time, because that's probably one of the most critical things of Crick's entire career, I think. He did not believe that the DNA here came from this planet, or
that's right.
Origin was here. Okay.
That's right. He didn't. And he published a book, in 1981, called Life Itself, which outlines this theory. And he came to the theory entirely on scientific grounds. Looking at the DNA molecule with its fantastic double helix structure and its ability to code for the construction of cells and proteins, in fact, its ability to form beings of all kinds as we know them, that this interaction between the double helix molecule of DNA and the proteins, in his view, was far too complicated to have just emerged by accident out of some kind of hypothetical primeval soup on planet Earth. Believe it or not, that's what most scientists claim, and I think those scientists are giving us a fairy story. They claim that the DNA molecule somehow just developed accidentally from different chemicals bumping against each other on the early Earth. Crick, the greatest scientist in this field, absolutely denied that. He said there's no way at all that the DNA molecule could have formed by accident on this planet in the time that was available for it.
Now, does he go on, Graham, to talk about how he believes it got here? I mean,
yes.
Are we talking about panspermia coming
from comets
and
stuff? We're talking about panspermia, and we're particularly talking about Crick's version of panspermia, which is directed panspermia. Crick didn't subscribe to the view that the molecules of life are just carried randomly through the universe on comets and asteroids and bump into planets and start life. In his view, it happened this way. He envisaged an alien civilization on the other side of the galaxy. He pointed out that there's been 15 billion years since the Big Bang, and that there was time for life to have evolved on another planet before the Earth was even formed, and the Earth was formed about 4 billion years ago. And his suggestion was that life evolved on another distant planet, and eventually, after billions of years, it produced a highly intelligent creature. And that highly intelligent creature developed a technology that was far in excess of anything we have today. And they realized, and remember, this is Crick, Francis Crick, the Nobel Prize winner, saying this, not me. They realized that their culture was doomed, that perhaps there was going to be a supernova explosion in the vicinity, and that they would all be wiped out, and that there was no way that they could physically escape from it. And he suggests that what they did was they took the most resilient life forms on their planet, containing the DNA of their planet, bacteria, which can survive in any environment, that they packed them into huge spacecraft, they froze billions in cryogenic suspension, billions of bacteria in these spacecraft, and they sent them off in the universe in all directions, hoping that those spacecraft carrying bacteria would collide with a planet in a suitable state of development, and there would begin to reproduce very rapidly, and the whole story of evolution would begin again, so that life would be preserved, life would be saved. That was Crick's theory of directed panspermia, and that's how he explains that the DNA molecule suddenly appears on this planet, and from a situation in which there was no life, we suddenly have life reproducing and replicating all over the planet.
What if it came to this planet through these portals that people see when they're under the influence of ayahuasca?
Perfectly possible. Crick, of course, did not consider that. He went far enough by suggesting that the DNA molecule couldn't have come from Earth, that it had to have been sent from elsewhere. But I do go into that possibility in the book, that we may be dealing with a transdimensional attempt to seed life on Earth, and that having done that, those beings then maintain an interest in life on Earth, and they may have a very specific project for life on Earth that we don't know yet fully what it is. That they realized that the way to develop life is through the process of evolution. So they sent very simple organisms to this planet, but packed with the DNA of their planet.
Yes.
And that those organisms then began evolving, and they realized that eventually, it might take billions of years, but eventually an intelligent creature just like them would evolve on this planet, and that intelligent creature might that they might have built into the DNA a method for that intelligent creature to access information that is on the DNA itself. This is the very extraordinary idea at the heart of this. You see, the mystery that I'm looking at in Supernatural is why people all around the world in altered states of consciousness see the same things and have the same experiences. One explanation for that, and I devote a great deal of space to it in the book, and I take it very seriously indeed, is that in these altered states of consciousness, we may be accessing real parallel dimensions and the beings who inhabit them. But another possibility, if Crick's theory is correct, is that those bacteria that started life on Earth 4 billion years ago contained DNA that had been genetically engineered, and that DNA may, it is quite possible, DNA carries vast quantities of information which is used to construct bodies and beings, that DNA may contain other kinds of information. It may, in fact, contain the entire accumulated knowledge of that hypothetical other civilization at the other side of the galaxy that seeded life on our planet. There is a thing called junk DNA. It's 97% of our DNA, and we don't know anything about it.
That's true.
We think we know a lot about DNA, but all we know about is the 3% that is involved in genes. The other 97% of DNA, our scientists are largely ignorant about, and that's why they tend to call it junk DNA, as though 97% of our DNA would be preserved down millions of years of evolution if it was just junk. Of course it's not junk. Of course there's something important to it. And scientists at Boston University, Dr. Eugene Stanley was the leader of the team, discovered during the 1990s that junk DNA has astonishing properties. It has astonishing linguistic properties. I won't go into the full details here. I published them in my book. But junk DNA has the same structure as all human languages. And Eugene Stanley at Boston University concluded that there must be a message written on our DNA. And what I'm adding to that is the possibility that it may be that message or those messages, perhaps an enormous interactive teaching machine that has been recorded on our DNA, which we may also access in altered states of consciousness. And that's why we all see the same thing, because we all have the DNA, the same DNA, and that DNA is in every cell of our bodies, including in our brain cells. And perhaps a mechanism had been devised billions of years ago to enable us to access hard information on our own DNA, which can reveal to us the secrets of why we are really here. That is the other possibility that I take very seriously in my book and explore very seriously. I don't take a dogmatic position. I'm not saying definitely it's because there are parallel universes and real spirits, and I'm not saying definitely it's because there's an interactive message recorded on our DNA. But what I'm saying is that the evidence seems to suggest that it is one or the other of those extraordinary possibilities. Either we enter altered states of consciousness and open a secret doorway inside our own minds that leads us through to other dimensions that are real but not normally accessible to us, or it's a secret chamber inside our own minds, a hall of records, a chamber of archives that we are able to enter in altered states of consciousness, which contain vital information for our future evolution.
What if, as you read in the Bible, the wording of fallen angels all has to do with this entry through this portal as well? Is that possible?
I believe that it does. I think that it is this extraordinary ability we have to enter altered states of consciousness and have experiences that are not available to us in normal states that lies beyond a huge range of mysteries. It lies behind a huge range of mysteries in the human past. And it may be the case that particularly if the spirit world explanation of this is the correct explanation, that beings are actually coming through that portal into this realm and contacting us at a physical level as well as at the level of consciousness. And that perhaps would be where the idea of fallen angels come from, and why, if we read in Genesis 6:6, why these sons of God, as they were called, wanted to mate with the daughters of men and wanted to produce offspring from the daughters of men.
Change the DNA, right?
Change the DNA. exactly as UFO abductees report that aliens want to do to us today, that they want to somehow, for some reason, they want to breed with us. They want to acquire our physicality.
Tell me a little bit about this plant that enables people to see the dead. I mean, this fascinates me.
Well, as part of my research, I went and worked with shamans and consumed several of the shamanic plant hallucinogens that they use. One of these plant hallucinogens comes from Central Africa, and it's called ibogaine. It's from the root bark of the iboga plant, which grows in the rainforests of Central Africa. And ibogaine is called the plant that enables men to see the dead. And the tradition is that a pygmy was climbing a tree, and that one of the high gods knocked him down from the tree and killed him, then cut off his fingers and toes and planted them in various parts of the forest. When his wife was looking for this lost pygmy, a voice told her to eat of a certain bush, and she would see her husband again. That was the bush that had grown from his parts that had been buried in the forest. And when she ate of the bush, she met her husband. And this is now the center of a religious system in Central Africa. It's called the Bwiti religion, where tens of thousands of people consume ibogaine in order specifically to contact and meet their own ancestors and to learn vital information from them, to enter the spirit realm into which they believe our souls journey after death, and to gain regular access to that spirit realm. And I myself have consumed ibogaine. It is a very powerful, a very terrifying experience. It's physically very demanding. I was desperately ill for 48 hours during this experience.
And that's still under the tutelage of a shaman.
In that case, it was under the tutelage of a healer working here in Britain. Although ibogaine is totally illegal in the United States, by some miracle, it remains legal in Britain. And just as I mentioned that ayahuasca has been used successfully to get drug addicts off hard drugs like heroin and cocaine, so also ibogaine has been used to the same effect here in Britain. And we have a number of healers who are administering it to drug addicts. Now, I'm not a drug addict, and I've never touched heroin or cocaine in my life, and I never intend to do so. But fortunately, some of these healers are also prepared to administer ibogaine for the purposes of consciousness exploration. And it was under that idea that I took ibogaine. And I also had a medical doctor present with me while I took it, because there have been deaths
from
the consumption of ibogaine. Ibogaine, if you have a weak liver or a weak heart, ibogaine can kill you. And for that reason, I had a doctor present with me throughout the entire 48-hour session.
Were you scared?
I was very scared. I was very scared by what it did to me physically. I felt like my body had been broken and torn apart.
Would you ever take it again?
I would, but I would do so with some fear and caution. The experience itself was so interesting and so instructive. I learned a great deal about myself. I did encounter ghosts. I had the sense of a crowd of ghosts standing around the couch on which I was lying during this experience, and one amongst them seemed to be the ghost of my father, who had recently died, and who I miss terribly and desperately. He didn't actually come to communicate with me in that vision, but I sensed his presence there, and I sensed that some important transaction had passed between us, which made it better somehow, made the fact of his loss, made it easier for me to deal with the fact of his loss.
Are they aware, Graham, that you have entered that altered state as much as you're aware of their presence? Are
yes.
they aware of yours?
Absolutely. This is universally reported, not only in my own experience, but by many others who have taken these shamanic plants, that the beings and the ancestors and the ghosts and spirits that we encounter in that other realm are indeed aware of us. They can see us all the time, but in normal consciousness, we can't see them. We have to find the ways to put our consciousness onto the plane that they are on, and then we become aware of them as well, but they're already there. They're already waiting for us. The same thing was reported by Rick Strassman's volunteers on DMT. that the beings they encountered knew they were coming, welcomed the fact that they had discovered this technology, as one of the beings described it, that they'd discovered this technology which would enable them to communicate more and more freely in the future. And when the DMT trip came to an end and the person's consciousness went back into this world, those beings pretty much said, bye-bye. See you again soon.
I'll be talking with Ed and Chris Sherwood tomorrow about crop circles. People don't understand how they are created. This could be another way. This could be a way of communication through this altered state portal.
Yes, I think that crop circles are intimately connected to this problem. It's not an accident, by the way, that the supernatural beings that everybody in Europe related to back in the Middle Ages, the so-called fairies and elves, danced in circles, often in the grass, and left circular marks in the grass after the fairy dance had been seen.
Leprechauns as well?
Leprechauns as well, yes. They're all part of this. They're all part of this other world. And it may be the case that these crop circles themselves mark the position of portals on this earth through which we can pass into the other world. This idea has not yet been properly explored. One thing I am certain of is that crop circles are a gigantic and extraordinary mystery.
Stay with us, Graham. We're going to open up the phone lines now. We'll give you an opportunity to talk with legendary Graham Hancock right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Graham Hancock. Graham, the research that you put into the book Supernatural, based on your other works, as you talk about you want to evolve, do things differently, was this pretty dramatic for you, a pretty dramatic change?
It was a very dramatic change. Of course, there are elements in common with my previous books. I am looking into a great mystery of the human past. It's just that it's much further back than the issue of a lost civilization. But as I got deeper and deeper into this investigation, I found that it did have a truly dramatic effect on me and on the way that I look at reality and on my approach towards the mystery of life. I'd always felt anyway that life is an extraordinary mystery, but the experiences that I have been through researching Supernatural and the information that I have gathered has convinced me that is the case. Our lives are deeply mysterious, and we only understand a tiny fraction of what is going on. The tools are available for us to understand more. But for some reason, in Western society, we've turned our backs completely on such techniques, and those are the techniques that are used by shamans all over the world, and that have been used by shamans for tens of thousands of years.
Do you know of, or have ever heard of, anything happening to a shaman in one of these altered states?
Yes. Sometimes bad things can happen to shamans, and that would happen if they encounter and get into a conflict with a negative or evil spiritual being.
Almost like an exorcism, isn't it?
Almost. In some ways it's different, because in the case of an exorcism, you have an individual in this world who is possessed by a spirit from the other world. In the case of shamans, they are sending their spirit from this world into the other world. So the balance of power changes. The shaman is much more in control of the situation. The shaman is not possessed. In fact, he is very often in a position to give orders to spirits and to instruct the spirits as to what to do. But sometimes it can go wrong, and there have been disastrous effects. And as a matter of fact, during one shamanic initiation that I witnessed in South Africa, I saw a healthy man in his mid-40s die.
Oh, my God.
And that happened, they said, because the spirits had taken his soul. He just dropped dead on the spot.
To the phones we go. Let's go to our wild card line. You are on the air with us. Hello there.
Good evening.
Hi.
George, Graham, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
George, real quick, in the movie Contact, if you replace the huge falling apparatus that Jodie Foster sat in with her taking a hit of DMT, the movie makes more sense.
True. You're absolutely right.
And, George, next time Major Ed Dames claims that he's looking for a repeatable target to remote view the alien, ask Ed to remote view the DMT molecule. Mr. Graham, I've got all your books. I love your work. I'm a big fan.
Thank you.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you if you've heard of Terrence McKenna's video, Alien Dreamtime.
Yes, and of course I've heard and know a great deal about Terence McKenna and the late, great, wonderful Terence McKenna. That man was a gift to this planet, and sadly he was taken from us prematurely by a brain tumor. Terence McKenna did extraordinary work, and I do report on his work in Supernatural.
If tryptamines caused our imagination to create all the unnecessary accessories we're surrounded by, from high heels to religious garbs and ceremonies, if religion at its core is an expression of human imagination, it seems religion has been co-opted by a salesman who's not comfortable with his own imagination nor a woman's imagination. It's kind of a self-castration to stop the story or this waking dream from changing from competing to sharing, meaning sharing the experience and not just selling an old story of a mystic in a cave having the experience. Thanks.
I think you're making a very important point there, and I'd like to pick up on a couple of points you make there. I have no doubt, and there's two chapters in my book that look at this in detail, that the origins of all religions lie in altered states of consciousness, sometimes very far back in the past. Just to take the case of Christianity, let's consider the position of St. Paul on the Damascus Road and the extraordinary altered state of consciousness experience he has, the blinding light, which transforms and changes his life. I think what happens is that the initial impulse of a religion comes from direct experiences that extraordinary people have in altered states of consciousness. But very quickly, within one or two generations, the bureaucrats step in and start running the religion on a power trip in order to promote their own power in society. And those individuals who claim to be the sole intermediaries between us and the spirit world, who hijack that role, actually have no spiritual contact whatsoever. And this is the sickness of modern religions. Though their roots do lie in direct experience of the spirit realm, all too often in the modern world, those religions have been hijacked by bureaucrats and politicians and money men who run the religions entirely for their own material purposes. And that's the sad state of the world we live in today.
All right. Thank you for that call. First time caller line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Good morning.
Hi.
Yes, it's a privilege. Good show again tonight, George.
We're on a roll.
It's a pleasure to speak with you, Mr. Hancock.
Thank you.
I would like for you, if you can, in an allotted amount of time you have, to expand on your 2% theory, if you will.
Yes. The first thing to understand is that our brains are electrochemical jellies, really. Every experience that we have is mediated through the electrochemistry of our brains. That does not mean that the experience can be reduced to the electrochemistry of our brains. It may mean that the electrochemistry is what we need to allow experiences through. Now, most of us have the electrochemical balance of our brains set on what Rick Strassman calls channel normal, so that we can function as industrious and competitive individuals in the material, physical world. But the evidence suggests that around 2% of every population, it doesn't matter whether it's the United States, Britain, Japan, wherever you go, have their brain chemistry at a slightly different level of tuning, and those individuals are able to enter altered states of consciousness spontaneously, and it is only in those altered states of consciousness that we can access these other realms and beings. So these are the fortunate, or perhaps some might say in some societies, the unfortunate individuals who find their consciousness projecting into the other world, into the spirit world, almost accidentally, out of control, just by chance. It can happen at any moment through the electrochemistry of their brains. For the rest of us, if we want to access those spiritual realms, then we have to change the electrochemical balance of our brain. We have to shake up its absolute commitment to channel normal, and we have to allow in the other realities. And the shamans around the world have developed a range of techniques for doing this, and one of them is the use of sacred plants, the plant hallucinogens, but as I mentioned earlier in the discussion, there are many other techniques as well. It seems to be all about the receiver wavelength of our brain, and just as a TV set can be retuned to pick up other stations, so our brains can be retuned to pick up other stations, and some of us, that 2%, have the ability to do that spontaneously.
Wonderful. My husband, who has just recently passed, thank you very much. He could do this. He also, if you will, subscribe to what he called the 2% theory.
Yes.
He said along with this that those people who could spontaneously go into an altered state of consciousness, okay, that those very possibly had been on the wheel much, much longer. My
yes.
husband was a Taoist. Much, much longer than perhaps the rest of us. And that was a contributing factor as to why we could do that. He also had an interesting theory concerning what our scientists call junk DNA. He said that those were all memories.
Yes.
Because
sounds very close to my work in a number of areas.
Wonderful. It's confirmation for me, especially confirmation from him.
Thank you.
But he also said that he would often tell me, he died of an illness, and during his times whenever he could sit and visit with me, he would tell me about being on a planet that was dying, and he was ready to, he was preparing to leave. That was of an ancient memory that he had. And tonight it is almost like speaking, like you were speaking with him and he was speaking with you the whole night.
I'm so pleased to hear you say that. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I think we're touching on the edge of a tremendous mystery here, and that it's beholden on all of us to explore that mystery, as your husband clearly did, rather than to simply ignore it, as so many scientists and skeptics want us to do.
You know, Graham, I tried to get Jacques Vallée on the program several months ago, and he just doesn't want to talk anymore. Whatever has happened to him in his career, he just wants to put it all behind him now. It's frustrating and puzzling to me.
Yes, I find it puzzling too, because Jacques Vallée, in his now unfortunately out-of-print book, Passport to Magonia, did a fantastic breakthrough work comparing the beings that were called fairies and elves in medieval Europe and the beings that we call aliens today, and showing absolutely that they are the same beings. And to that I've added the spirits that shamans communicate with. But for some reason, having made that astonishing breakthrough and put it into the public consciousness back in 1969, Jacques Vallée really never returned to this earlier inquiry. There were some compilations of his work which touched on it again, but he never went into it again in depth and in detail. Perhaps he learned something that
frightened him, or something
that was scary made him feel that he wouldn't go further. Perhaps he suffered such a hostile and negative reaction from the down-to-earth, literalist, materialist scientific community that it was just too difficult. I don't know. We can only speculate on that. It would be great if Jacques Vallée himself would speak on the matter. But the wonderful thing that he did was he put a new idea into our culture, and that idea is still there, and it's possible to explore it and develop it further. And that's one of the things that I decided to do in Supernatural, was to take that inquiry that he let go of in 1969 and to add to it all the new evidence that has become available since then, and the results really are astonishing. But I want to pay tribute to Jacques Vallée and to the wonderful work that he did, and I wish some publisher would put his book back into print.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Michael in Norfolk, Virginia.
Sure, Michael.
Dr. Hancock, you mentioned the work of Rick Strassman.
Yes.
And also Francis Frick.
Yeah.
And we, of course, know that special legal or legislative kinds of dispensations had to be provided to Rick Strassman to do his research.
That's right.
And that brings up a great question with regard to the whole progress of science in this area and its relationship to legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Our host, George Norrie, has been one of the bravest men in America in regards to a subject of dealing with our own recognized and accepted shamans here in the United States, the shamans of the pharmaceutical industries, the big pharmaceuticals.
Yes.
Now, what this audience needs to know, and I'd like to know how this relates to your work in Great Britain,
mm-hmm.
but what this audience needs to know at times like this, when we have a Supreme Court justice who's going to be, who's nominated to become, I mean, we have a man who's nominated to enter the Supreme Court and become 11.11% of the voting power of the third branch of government in the United States. Why should we not, as an audience and as Americans, be bombarding our senators and especially the Judiciary Committee at this time on critical questions like what we are hearing a lot of rumors about, mandatory flu vaccinations and its relationship to the next nominee? Because here's the issue. If during 1918 we were not allowed to ask the question, what was the relationship of the distribution of food at that time through the Catholic Mass and the great worldwide epidemic that came about, that same kind of bias against honest, intelligent, scientific inquiry to solve our problems, while on the other hand, we are being led into a mass-like acceptance of mandatory inoculations of some shamanized...
We are being led into the abyss. I wouldn't call the representatives of Big Pharma shamans. I would call them merchants of death.
They're opposite shamans.
They're not shamans at all. They're merchants of death. But you're touching on a very interesting point, because government has got itself involved in our societies in the control of individual consciousness. We have actually legislated about what experiences people may and may not have with their consciousness. And if people choose to have experiences with their consciousness that go against that legislation, then they can be sent to prison. At the same time, our big pharmaceutical companies are pushing psychiatric drugs like Prozac and Ciroxat onto the mass of the population. Millions of people are taking these drugs and having their minds numbed as a result. And this is the same system of government that will put us into prison if we experiment with our consciousness with plant hallucinogens that have been in use in human society for tens of thousands of years. It's clear that there are vested interests involved in this situation, and that our societies, through our governments, are seeking to take complete control of the consciousness of the population. This is a very insidious, very dangerous situation. It reminds me of the Spanish Inquisition, and I think Big Pharma is leading us down the road to perdition.
And you know what? It's been going on since the beginning of mankind. They've always tried to put their thumb on top of people.
Yeah, they don't want people to have direct experiences. Every experience must be controlled through bureaucracies and big power organizations and the money man. And most of us have been so brainwashed by the propaganda that surrounds these issues that we don't even think it's a problem anymore. It's a huge problem. It's a gigantic problem. We need to take control again of our own consciousness. If we do not own and control our own consciousness, then we own nothing. It's an extraordinary invasion of human rights that adults are not allowed to experiment with their own consciousness with shamanic plants that have been in use by human beings and have been producing beneficial effects for tens of thousands of years. Instead, we have a climate of fear and dishonesty and false propaganda surrounding these substances, and that is connected to the interests of the big pharmaceutical companies.
Stay with us. We'll be back with final questions with our special guest tonight, the legendary Graham Hancock, right here. He's live in London. I'm in Los Angeles, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, Grant, before we take the final phone calls, give me your take, your reaction to, of course, the global flood and all the different stories that have surrounded that.
Well, that goes back to an earlier phase of my work, particularly to Fingerprints of the Gods and my last book on the lost civilization subject, which is called Underworld. I don't think it's any mystery that we have a universal myth of a flood, that all cultures, almost all cultures at any rate, remember a great flood that destroyed a great civilization, because at the end of the Ice Age, 12,500 years ago, there were precisely such floods, devastating floods, and sea level rose by more than 400 feet, and 10 million square miles of the best land on Earth was swallowed up by the sea at that time. I think these are memories of real events.
Okay, back to the phones we go.
Before we do,
yes,
can I just mention again, because I know we'll be in a rush at the end of the show, I am giving two lectures in the United States, one on the 12th of November, one on the 17th of November, and details of those lectures are on my website, www.grahamhancock.com, on the Supernatural page. So if anybody wants more information on that, and also how to get this book in the United States, at the moment it's not available on in the bookshops, Supernatural, but it will be available through Amazon.com and Amazon.ca in Canada. Just search Graham Hancock, Supernatural.
Wildcard Line, you're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you doing?
Good. Thanks for holding.
Mr. Hancock, how are you doing? What an honor.
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for coming on.
Okay, I'm on a cell, so I hope my signal's coming through. I have the first thing I'd like to suggest is perhaps you could do a round table with Maurice Cotterell,
yes,
and David Icke.
Mm-hmm.
And of course yourself,
mm-hmm,
and then maybe Lawrence Gardner, and you could all talk about perhaps the multidimensional aspect of consciousness. You know,
I hope Jeremy Narby would be invited to that round table as well. Jeremy Narby, author of The Cosmic Serpent, a wonderful author and investigator.
Yes, I'd like to put one notion forward, if I may, and. It's taken me about 44 years to figure it all out, but everything of a metaphysical or a mystery school nature is in the Bible. You just have to know how to spot it.
Sure.
And instead of going to the plants or thinking that the answer to the matrix is outside of you, if you just remain a good, holy, clean, and sovereign person, then the mountain starts to come to you, and you have to go to the mountain. And as you see the synchronicity and the coincidences of your life story, by simply being clear, you activate the DMT molecule in your pineal gland, but most importantly, you activate your heart chakra. You start caring about plants and animals and people. And there's a responsibility being in a body that you may have to defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to close by getting your comments. There's two subjects on this show that come up often. One of them is about culling the Earth's population and the pharmaceutical boys and the secret societies and going back to the old Austrians and all of that. And the other one is Earth changes. Do you think the crop circles could be a foreboding of Earth changes, and that the pharmaceuticals with the avian flu and the heavy boot of authoritarianism is preparing us? It's a misdirection to keep our eyes off the Earth changes. And thank you for listening to all that.
Well, just to pick up your point, all I know for sure is that our civilization is marching blindfold into the abyss right now. We need a big change to be made in our own consciousness and in the way that we approach our lives and in the way that our societies function. We have to take back control of our own societies and stop this juggernaut that is destroying the world. So if there are to be Earth changes, it may well be that those Earth changes will come through human darkness and human folly and human ignorance.
You're going through a metamorphosis, Graham, aren't you?
Yes.
I can tell. In just the years I've talked to you, I can tell.
Yeah, you're right.
East of the Rockies, welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Hi, George. This is Joseph in Harrisburg, PA.
Joseph, thank you.
Hi, Mr. Hancock.
Hello there.
I would like to touch on the UFO thing, if I could.
Sure.
Do you believe, then, it's all within the mind and what anyone has ever seen is not real?
No. I believe that what is seen is real, but I also believe that we see it through our consciousness, just as we see everything else through our consciousness. It is real. We just have to change the level of tuning of our consciousness in order to access these absolutely real experiences. Every experience we have even eating a potato involves our brains and our minds. What we have to do is take our focus off the mundane and everyday and material and physical aspect of life and refocus our consciousness on other aspects of life below the level that is normally accessed by normal consciousness, or rather above that level. So no, I believe that these experiences are real, but that if we want to access them in a systematic manner, then we need to use altered states of consciousness in order to do that. We will not access them in normal, everyday, alert, problem-solving consciousness, and if we try to do so, we will fail.
Well, but you're, what I'm saying is, if I experienced a UFO sighting, I could physically touch it?
Yes, your consciousness could touch it, because it seems that our consciousness, once out of the body, takes on a body of its own.
Well,
And it could touch you.
When I was a teenager, I had several UFO sightings, and they were as real as seeing an airplane in the sky.
I believe you saw something real. I believe you were privileged to see something real that most people in a normal state of consciousness cannot see. I absolutely agree with you. I think these experiences are real. I think we need to redefine our understanding of reality. We have to stop thinking that that the only real things are things that exist in this material, physical dimension. There may be other dimensions which we can gain access to, which are also real and which we do not fully understand. And I think UFOs are one manifestation of that crossover between other dimensions and this dimension. But both of the dimensions are real.
Well, what I was trying to say was that the experiences that I had, and others were with me when I experienced them, they were of this realm. They were of the physical realm. They weren't something...
Well, how can you be sure that they didn't simply manifest in this physical realm, but come from another realm?
Well,
are you saying that they were generated by this realm, the same realm that makes potatoes and motor cars, or are you saying perhaps that they came from another realm and projected into this realm?
No, they're as real as the potato and the automobiles.
I'm not denying their reality, but are you saying that they're something just produced by the Earth, this physical Earth, and that there's nothing else beyond this physical Earth? What is your belief on that? Do you believe?
No, I'm saying they came from somewhere else. They were a UFO from somewhere else, not here. But they
not
were
here,
physical,
exactly. Now, how do you know where that somewhere else is, or what that somewhere else is?
Could it be that
somewhere else is another dimension rather than another planet in this physical universe?
Oh, I don't know what dimension they may have come from. All I'm saying is that they presented a physical presence.
I agree with you on that.
In front of me.
There's massive evidence for the presentation of a physical presence in this universe of beings and objects from other dimensions, and I do report that evidence in my book. I'm not arguing with you about the reality of these experiences. I'm only arguing about the techniques that we need to use in order to access these experiences. And you were lucky enough at that moment to be able to access these experiences.
All right, good. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Let's move on. West of the Rockies, welcome to Coast to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, go ahead.
April from Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
Was wondering if... Hancock. Oh, good morning.
Speak up, April.
What do you know about receiving names from beings in an astral plane after having an abduction of some kind?
Receiving what from beings, sorry?
Names. Yes.
Many shamans who enter the other world, just as UFO abductees enter the other world, in their experiences, are given another name in the other realm. It's extremely common for a shaman in an altered state of consciousness to return from his out-of-body journey and report that he has been given a new name by the spirits who he encountered, and that this new name is a vital and important part of his identity. And in fact, in the story of Ibogaine that is told by the Pygmies in Central Africa, the individual involved in that also receives a new name from the spirit world. So I think there's something very much in common between these experiences that you're reporting with UFO abductees.
Wow. Because it's strange, because I got the name, and I looked for it online everywhere, trying to figure out what this name actually means.
Mm-hmm.
And I used it as a screen name, because I like to go into the paranormal rooms and everything
mm-hmm.
online. And this guy from Hawaii...
What is that name? Will you tell us?
Akia.
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 Sounds good.
A-K-E-A, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But he said it means beings of light or
yeah.
light bringer. And I about went cold. Because,
beings of light.
Yeah, because that's
now you're giving me the shivers because during my experiments with altered states of consciousness in the Amazon, drinking the shamanic brew ayahuasca, the first beings that I encountered on my out-of-body journeys were beings of light. They glowed like their faces glowed as though they were lit up with neon.
Yeah. They were healers or something because every time I had a dream about them, I was sick.
Yeah.
I would feel better. It was unbelievable.
Well, that's very interesting because one of the side effects of ayahuasca is that it does cause terrible nausea as well.
Oh. Okay.
So, interesting. Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. Appreciate you being part of the problem. And the ayahuasca that you take.
Yeah.
And again, you recommend that you are taking it with a shaman.
Absolutely. I think this is vitally important.
It's idiotic if anybody takes it by themselves, even if they go to the Amazon, right?
Yeah, very bad mistake. First of all, they're likely to get the dose totally wrong. And secondly, the experiences that they will have will be so at first so disorienting and so terrifying that it may disturb them extremely badly. The only way to reduce that disturbance, that disorientation, is to take the ayahuasca in the company of an experienced shaman who is the master of that other realm. And he or she, because there are female shamans as well in the Amazon, will ground you and help you through the experience. After you have repeated the experience many times, you might get to the point where you would be in a position to take it on your own and where you become effectively a shaman yourself. But for beginners with ayahuasca, it's vitally important to take the substance with the shamans who know what they're doing. And I should add that throughout the Amazon region, whether we're talking about Peru or Brazil or Ecuador, the consumption of ayahuasca is protected under laws of religious freedom. This substance is not illegal in those countries. It is totally legal because they believe that it is a substance that provides access for our consciousness to the spirit realms. They believe that it's a religious issue, and they believe that every individual has the right of religious freedom. So fortunately, in those countries in the Amazon, these substances are not illegal. And taking them illegally in our countries also adds to the terror and the discomfort of the experience. So all in all, I would urge nobody to take this substance unguided. The best place to take it, if it's possible to put together the funds, is to go to the Amazon and take it there. And there you will find shamans who are willing to work with you and feel indeed that they have a mission to work with people from the West to reintroduce us to the spiritual realms that we have cut ourselves off from.
What does it do to your dreams later? Anything?
There's a curious interaction with dreams, and I have revisited these realms in dreams. And sometimes when I'm lying at the edge of sleep, the characteristic visions of ayahuasca begin to impinge on my mind, and I sense that I'm slipping over again into that other realm. So it did make a permanent change, I would say, in my consciousness, but a permanent and very positive change, and one that I welcome and believe has been of great value to me.
Let's go to our first-time caller line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
This is George Norris. Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I'm from New Jersey, but I'm in upstate New York right now. I'm in Hudson making a delivery. I'm going to make it quick because there's a lot of background noise. I'm loading the trailer.
Yes.
First of all, thank you for taking my call. I'm a new listener. I'm a truck driver, so you helped me to stay awake at night because it's a pretty boring ride up to Mid-Hudson.
You're welcome.
I just wanted to say to Mr. Hancock, I have one of your books. My girlfriend introduced me to your writings, your research. We have Fingerprints of the God. But the one thing that bothers me, and I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the one of the things that bothers me about European or researchers, people who don't acknowledge that they have African descent, you tend to refer to Africans as pygmies. There is no section in Africa called Pygmy. I'm just wondering why is. I mean, I know there are many different tribes.
Well, I'm sorry. There are Pygmies in Central Africa, and they are highly dignified people with their own culture and their own ancient history, and they do refer to themselves also as Pygmies. It's just a general word in the language. They happen to be very small, but they happen to have preserved a precious gift of knowledge for human culture. To use the word does not mean that I'm putting them down, especially when it's a word that they use themselves. It just means that that's the word that is used. My emphasis is not on the stature of these people, but on their astonishing intellect, their amazing culture, their incredible knowledge of the rainforest in which they live, and the gifts that they have to give to Western civilization. So please don't believe that I'm putting the Pygmy cultures down. Far from it. I think that they're amongst the most wonderful and extraordinary cultures on this planet.
Well said, Graham. Just a few more minutes to go, so I want to take the time again to talk about your very special conference and where people can go. On your website, of course, you've got information. But again, when will it be?
Well, there's two events that I'm speaking at. One is the CPAC conference, which is looking at precession and the rise and fall of civilizations. And that's in Sedona on the 12th of November. And then the second one is in New York City, at the Chapel of the Sacred Mirrors on the 17th of November. And that lecture will be totally devoted to my new book, Supernatural. And details of both lectures are on my website, www.grahamhancock.com, that's G-R-A-H-A-M-H-A-N-C-O-C-K, on the Supernatural page. Go to the lecture schedule, and you will see precise details of these lectures and how to attend them. And if I may again just simply add, unfortunately, my book is not published in the U.S. yet. It will be published in the U.S. in 2006 in the bookshops. But it is available right now on Amazon.com. Just search Graham Hancock Supernatural, and it has just today been published in Canada. So it's available in the bookshops in Canada and on Amazon.ca as well. And again, all details of this are on my website, grahamhancock.com, on the page called Supernatural.
Graham, in 30 seconds, by being in this altered state, do they also have the ability to prophesize the future?
Yes. There is profound evidence of that, of future events being foreseen by shamans. And again, I do go into this in places in the book, and this is, again, something else that tells me that there's an area of human experience here that we in the West have neglected for far too long and that we need to rediscover. It may have vital implications for the future of the human race. We can't turn our back on it any longer.
Graham, always a pleasure to talk with you, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed. It's been lovely to talk to you and your callers.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesur, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. Somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on the next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.